podcasts.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Megan Cornwell. This is the show where we delve into a person's life, faith and ministry. It's brought to you in association with the UK's leading Christian magazine, Premier Christianity. If you would like a free sample copy of our latest issue, head to our website, premierchristianity.com/freesample. Today on The Profile, I'm speaking with Beck Hill. Beck is an award-winning comedian who incorporates arts and crafts into her stand-up routines to create something she describes as paper puppetry. She's a regular on comedy panel shows, and her one-liners have featured in the best jokes lists of national newspapers. Her latest show, I'll Be Beck, will be performed at the Edinburgh Fringe this summer. Beck, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
On The Profile, we like to start by asking about how you became a Christian.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a bit about your personal faith journey?
Yeah, it's different to most other Christians I know, because my family weren't practicing. I would say they're very much agnostic when I was growing up. And I'll give them this to them. They were very open about talking about what other people believe in and all this sort of thing. And I liked that because it meant that when I had questions, they'd say, oh, well, some people believe this and other people believe this. And it just sort of gave me a really nice scope of all the different sort of belief systems and faiths and things like that, as well as neither. And it meant that when I did eventually find faith, I felt very much like I'd chosen this and it was something that felt right. So I was about, I think I was maybe about 12 or 13, and a friend of mine, a really close friend of mine, was going on church camp. And I used to go on a lot of summer camps as a kid anyway with the YMCA. And so she was a bit nervous and she said, oh, will you come on camp with me? I really want to go, but I'm really nervous socially. I was like, yeah, of course, I love camp. And we went on this Easter camp. And obviously they talk about Easter and the point of Easter there. And I'd never really, like, I vaguely knew about the Easter story, but I didn't feel like I really knew Jesus at the time. And they talked about that. And it was a mix of learning about that and then just meeting all these incredibly nice people who were so inclusive and loving. Like, the love that was a part of that group was so intense. And I just remember thinking, like, oh, this is really good. Like, I feel that this is a path I really want to follow and take, because it felt like a very good way of living life. Mm. And I also it was the first time I really felt God as a presence. I remember having a moment where I asked my leader, but you say God's everywhere, but he doesn't, like, watch us when we're on the toilet, does he? And she was like, well, he can see everyone, but, like, if you can see everyone, then there's no embarrassment, because there's no secrets and there's nothing to be ashamed of, because you on the toilet is no different to someone else on the toilet. But I remember that being really, like, mind-blowing, the idea that God can see you on the toilet, which seems so weird now. But yeah, I just, so I came to faith at that camp and then sort of started attending church. My friend, it was a really nice Uniting Church in Australia. And
which is where you're from.
Yes, where I'm from is where the accent's from. And I went to youth group and I loved youth group. And I just, it's hard to explain, but it's that sort of really wholesome fun that especially the older you get, it's kind of harder to grab hold of. And I just had a really happy teenage life because of it. And thankfully my parents were quite supportive and happy to take me to church. And I led on a few things, and I got to the point that I did actually entertain going to Bible college when I finished high school, because I was looking at maybe becoming a high school chaplain. But then I ended up starting comedy and my career went off in a completely different path. So I really enjoyed my church when I first came to faith, and then I started going, because I was a teenager, so I was sleeping in on the weekend. So I started going to an evening service, and then I found the minister changed at my church, and a lot of the things that I'd come to love about the faith, I found some of the people there and a part of that new leadership didn't quite follow with what I'd come to know about faith and what I felt was right according to Jesus's teaching. So that
what
made
kind
me
of things.
So there was suddenly became a very big focus on growing the church. Became very much about getting more people into the church. And during that time, the friend that introduced me to faith was going through a tough time. And I remember speaking to someone saying, I think we need to give her some attention because I think she's struggling at the moment. And nothing happened. And eventually she left the church because she just felt like no one cared. And I was like, oh, you're so caught up on trying to find new sheep that you're losing your flock. And I felt that was a bit, that was the first one that made me feel quite uncomfortable. And then they started doing the collection twice every service, which made me feel a little bit uncomfortable again, because then I felt like it was becoming more about the financial side of it. Mm. And then the final problem for me was the topic of one of the members of the congregation came up, because I don't actually know what happened, but I have the feeling that he was in the closet, and I sort of said, oh, has he come out, just in a very casual way. And someone said, oh no, but you know, if he is gay, we will fix that. And I just went, oh, this is very far away from the sort of loving inclusionary faith that I came to follow. So I ended up stopping going to that church, but I still felt that I could still very much feel the presence of God in my life, and I still very much believed in the teachings of Jesus. So I didn't lose my faith, but I very much lost faith in the church at that point. At the same point, one of the ministers who'd been at my original church, they'd sort of exposed themselves to someone. I don't think it was anyone underage, but I think that they'd had a moment, and it kind of really made me very uncomfortable with the idea of how much power some churches have, and then the people in those churches. And unfortunately, some of the people that I went to the bigger night church with, who I at the time just saw as the pinnacle of what a Christian is, and you know, they were the biggest Christian couple, and oh, that's, you know, that's what you aim for. And since then, they've left the church because they ended up becoming involved in the running of the church, and then they saw where the money was going, and they both immediately lost all faith in it because they felt like it was a scam. And that was really disappointing. I think it's a shame, because I feel like the running of a lot of things end up completely hiding the whole point of the religion. So I sort of tried a lot of different churches. When I moved over here, there's a couple that I tried. I never had as big of issues with the ones over here, but I just didn't quite feel a part of them. And then a couple of years ago, a friend who had read How to Be a Bad Christian and a Better Human Being by Dave Tomlinson had invited me to his church, which happened to be a 20-minute walk from my flat in Holloway. So it's St. Luke's in Holloway. And she said, oh, I'm going to check out this church because I really like this reverend's book. Come with me. And she's had a very similar story to mine as well. So we both went along, and it was like, I don't know how to explain. It's like going to a family reunion where you're like, oh, I haven't, it felt right. And I felt
something clicked
mm-hmm. very much. So,
and that's where you've been ever since?
I've been there ever since. Yeah. I'm a very big fan. I don't get to go as much as I'd like because I do stand up for kids, and that means a lot of my shows are on the weekends. But what I love about it, as well as when I go back, I never feel like I'm never made to feel like I've let people down or anything, because the only person that misses out when I don't go is me. Thankfully, they've started putting their services up as podcasts, so every now and then I'll try and listen to what the last sermon was. But it's sort of helped reignite a...
And in terms of where your comedy first started, I understand that your first ever gig was to your youth group.
One of the youth groups that I went to. So around the time that I became a little suspicious of the big church that I was going to, there was a much, much smaller community church whose youth group I liked because it was unconventional and dumb, and you know, a lot of the games involved, like who could drink the most soy sauce. Like it was the sort of thing where I think parents would have been a bit mortified to know what we did. A lot of the people who attended, it was incredibly diverse, and it meant that there was a real sort of mix of events and everything that we're getting up to, but it still had that core of love, and I really liked that. But I sort of outgrew it, unfortunately, as I got older. But when I was there, they did a talent show. And so I was like, oh, I'll do a stand-up routine. And they were so supportive. It was such a lovely group. And I remember I did it. And I don't even remember my jokes. I think one of them was something like, oh, no, I remember one of my first jokes. And it was, so I just got my first job outside of high school, you know, like my little night job. And it was at Pizza Hut. So I was like, oh, I work at a... I can't say where I work, but let's just say it's a hut of pizza. What I hate is when people walk in and they look at the menu for ages and then they say, I'll have a pizza. What else were you going to order? Shoes? And I thought that was the pinnacle of comedy at that age. I think I was about 15. And I remember I did about 3 minutes and they were so nice. They were so lovely and so supportive, which I just don't think you could get in many places, to be honest. I think if I'd tried that at a stand-up comedy club, there's probably no chance I would have ever tried it again. But yeah, since then, I remember they were going, oh, you should be a stand-up comedian. You should go, oh, maybe one day. So yeah, that was technically my first ever gig. Yeah.
Brilliant. Do you think God has a sense of humour?
Oh, absolutely. Have you seen The Body? Ah, it's horrible. I think only someone with a good sense of humour could make anything that looks like humans. Yeah, I think absolutely. In fact, there's another comic called Paul Savage, and he did a show called Every Joke in the Bible. So I don't want to step on any of his toes because he's nailed a lot of it. But there's a lot of really nice bits that he sort of has pointed out from the Bible that are actually pretty much jokes. There's a couple of puns in the Bible, which I love, a lot of wordplay. So I would definitely recommend checking him out, Paul Savage, with Every Joke in the Bible.
And Beck, in reviews of your stand-up comedy, you're often described as a ray of sunshine or refreshingly uncynical. Are you naturally an optimistic person who sees the funny side of life, or do you actively find ways to cultivate joy?
Oh, I think originally when I started, it was very much just how I was wired. And then as you get older, you start to feel a little more cynical. And then I have to actively try and focus on the positives, because otherwise it can become quite, can drag you down a bit. And what I've most recently realized is that the best way to cultivate optimism is to look to those around you. Because I think there's a lot of people out there who can make you feel depressed. And I think if you sit there and do nothing, then it's very easy to go, oh, you know, no one's doing anything about this and we're powerless and people are always going to be littering, even, you know, when they realize what problems it's causing and all that sort of stuff. And it's very easy to start not liking humanity. And I've found, mainly with thanks to social media and with performing, is that the more I reach out to people and ask for positive things, then it really reinstates my faith in humanity. So, for instance,
could you give me some examples?
I was going to say, more recently, I'd asked on Twitter and on Facebook. I just said, because I was feeling a bit down. I know a lot of people like to share photos of their pets and stuff, but sometimes I get a bit overwhelmed by pictures of animals and babies and things. And so I just said, can you, if you make anything, or if you've ever created anything or made anything, can you post it in the replies? I'd like to get a whole thread of creativity. And both on Facebook and Twitter, I was just overwhelmed by the amount of things that people are constantly doing. So, and so different. There were people who had drawn pictures or painted or sculpted or sewn something, or here's a meal I made yesterday. Here's the fence that I put up. Here's the flowers that I planted earlier this year and they're finally blooming. You know, just all these little things like that, and totally ranging from, you know, whether it was just a hobby or something that they just had to do because it needed to be done, to people who are professional artists or musicians or anything like that. And it was just, and for several days, my notifications was just people showing me these incredible photos that are just, or videos and things, and it just made me feel really, in fact, I didn't really get anything cynical in those threads. It was just people excited to share something that they've done, and that made me feel just really, oh, yeah, we're quiet. Because there's a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, which is an incredible book for anyone who's looking for an outlet in terms of creativity. And you don't have to have a creative job. In fact, I would argue it's better for people who don't have a creative job, because it makes you realize how important it is to allow yourself to be creative. And it very much talks about how we've been created, and we've been created in order to create further. And I love that. I love the idea that God, as a creator, has given us their ability to create more. And God takes great joy in seeing us create. And it's such a lovely way of living. So it's a good book. Artist Way, thoroughly recommend it. But just seeing all these other people creating, and I just felt that, I feel like that's what God must feel like when they watch what we're up to and what we're doing. You know, it just made me feel really, oh, how great are people? And then I did some other ones where I just said, you know, what's a way that you've been useful recently? Because again, I think sometimes you need permission to say that you've done something. Because sometimes it does feel a bit like you're bragging if you're like, oh, I volunteer on this, or I've walked an old lady across the road. If you just say that, then everyone's like, oh, good for you. What are you looking for? Points. But if someone actively says, tell me a time you've been, because also it makes people think about the times that they've been useful. I think there's a lot of people, myself included, who sometimes think, oh, I'm not actually adding anything to society. I'm a terrible person. I'm not doing anything actually useful. But when someone asks you to name one and you're like, oh, I guess I did this, that's nice. Like, it's, you can start to, sometimes you just have to take a moment to go, oh, I'm not as bad as I tell myself constantly. So yeah, that was just, they're nice. I think we need to spend more time celebrating other people sometimes. It's very easy to get down.
It's often said, isn't it, that some of the funniest people are also some of the saddest.
Mm.
Have you found that to be the case with people you've met on the circuit?
Yeah, I think it's because a lot of comedy is about observing, and sometimes that's observing the world or observing yourself. And when you're constantly assessing yourself and what you're saying and what you're thinking and the way you act, that can get quite, you can overthink a lot of things. And I think when you overthink those things, it's very possible to dig yourself into a hole. You can have those moments where you're like, oh, this didn't work, I'm having a bad day, oh, and then it just sort of gains. I feel it's hard, because most of the people I know are in the industry, so I'm like, yeah, they are sad, but I don't know, maybe everyone is sad and I just don't know because I don't talk to them as much. But yeah, I think there is I think when you spend so much time in your own head, it can lead to being a bit more like that. Or maybe sad people are attracted to comedy because they need a way of looking outside of the way that they're, more often than not, the chemistry of their brain is making them feel, and they need to find external ways of joy. So it seems to work for some people.
Are there any subjects that are no-go areas for you because of your faith?
I definitely, there's no-go. Well, it's an interesting argument, because I know a lot of people say that you should be able to joke about anything, and I think that needs to be reworded, because I think there are ways of dealing with certain things with humor, but I think you should always have a level of responsibility there. So it's very easy to write jokes about something where they might be irresponsible jokes, because the comedy comes from making fun of a victim or making light of something that is actually quite horrible and serious to a lot of people. And sometimes when you make light of something, it becomes such a joke that it's then not taken seriously as it should. So for me personally, I would like to do jokes about certain types of politics or things like that, but I find it very hard to write those well without it just coming across as me being preachy. I find it very hard for me to insert humor in them because I find those topics too serious. But that said, there are some comedians out there who can write jokes about, I mean, as a massive one, Bridget Christie won an award for her show about feminism, and she did it incredibly well. Hannah Gadsby's Nanette is a perfect example of someone who can talk about the struggles of what it was especially like to start doing comedy in a very homophobic country that is still struggling to get past that. And I can't do that because that's not my story to tell. And I don't think I have the strengths in that area to talk about those things. And that's fine because there are other comics covering those stories and doing them really well. And I think there are some comics who feel, especially new ones, who feel that to be a good comic, you should be able to write about any single thing. And I think, well, no, because that's not your story or that's not your voice. So maybe concentrate on what you care about and what you can use your comedic voice for, rather than, oh, I'm just going to write jokes about anything. One of the things that annoys me a lot is when people say, if someone says makes a joke about a subject that is taboo, and then a lot of people say, oh, it wasn't even funny. And what I hate about that as an excuse is that it suggests that if it's funny, that makes it okay. And I don't think that's true. I don't think, if anything, I think that, yeah, you might be able to write something funny about something. That doesn't mean you should. And it's up to you whether you want to do that. And I get that some people want to be edgy and break taboos and stuff. But I always put it this way. I always say a poisonous berry might be really delicious, but that doesn't make it less poisonous. So you can write a joke about something that's really funny, and that doesn't make it any better.
And in terms of your particular brand of comedy, you have this incredible paper puppetry that you use. Can you just explain what that is for those of us who don't know about it, and how you came up with the idea in the first place?
Yeah, okay. So the paper puppetry is essentially, it's like a pop-up book, but it's two-dimensional. Mainly, most of the stuff only moves across the page rather than coming three-dimensional out. So I guess it's sort of a bit like live animation in a sense. It's a lot of tabs, a lot of pull tabs. And I came across it because it's funny we talk about this after taboo things, because I'm not proud of the original thing. It's not the worst, but I'm not proud of it. I'd written a sketch. I mean, I think I was about 18 at the time, and I'd written a sketch about a superhero called Lazy Eye Man, and he captures a supervillain who's Monocle Man. And they have this big sort of, I've caught you and you know, I've foiled your plan for world domination. And they have this big thing. And then Monocle Man says, I'm really sorry. I didn't catch what you're saying. I was too distracted by your eye. And while I had friends with lazy eyes in audiences where I performed that, really enjoy it, in the end, I thought, I don't want to be one of those guys who says, I'm happy doing this joke because I have a friend with a lazy eye. So in the end, I sort of went, oh, I'm better than that. I can write better stuff than that. But it felt... it wasn't punching down terribly, but it was one of those ones where I went, oh, I can write something funnier and better than that, that everyone can enjoy without any discomfort. But that was the original sort of sketch I'd written, and I didn't know how to perform it. And I didn't want to bring an audience member on stage to do it with me. And I didn't want to have to, I can't do voices. I can only do my voice. So I thought what I'll do is I'll draw the characters as a one frame cartoon, and I'll put it on a big flip chart so that everyone can see it. And then I realized that if I was going to try and show who was talking, I'd have to give them moving mouths, as I said, because I can't do voices. So I gave them little moving mouths so they could talk to each other, and then you knew who was talking in that bit. And that itself, that actual technique, got really good reaction, and it was the moving mouth stuff that got the laugh. So thankfully I realized that and went further with that rather than just writing more material about optical problems.
That brings us to the end of part one of today's show. But join us again to hear from Beck Hill right after this.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue,
we have an exclusive peek inside a modern Christian utopia when we visit the Bruderhof in East Sussex, a 300-strong community where all possessions are shared, crime and divorce are non-existent, and life is centred around Christ. Plus, we discover the evangelists reaching out to goths, metalheads and Satanists. And we say goodbye to Soul Survivor after 26 years of the UK's best-loved Christian youth festival. All this and more in August's issue.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
World-class Bible teachers, including Albert Moeller and Alistair Begg, are coming to London. Ligonier Ministries' first ever UK conference is taking place this September, and you can go free. You'll get two tickets worth £118 completely free of charge when you subscribe to Premier Christianity magazine. Subscribe now and get your free tickets to the Light of the World conference at premierchristianity.com/subscribe.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to The Profile, here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Megan Cornwell, Deputy Editor of Premier Christianity magazine. That's the monthly magazine that sponsors this show. If you would like a free sample copy of our latest issue, just go to premierchristianity.com/free sample. But for now, time to rejoin my interview with Beck Hill. Let's listen in. Have you had any criticism from Christians about any of your routines? I'm thinking particularly ones that incorporate faith. So you did that kind of silly version of the Lord's Prayer.
It's essentially a phonetical version of the Lord's Prayer that's very silly and involves lots of bums. The first time I debuted that was at my church for a comedy fundraising gig. So I was confident enough that it was fine. And they were really, yeah, they really enjoyed it. No one complained. Then everyone, but then again, my church is awesome, so I think everyone has a pretty good sense of humor. Largely, it's been pretty positive, and in fact, I would say there was a lot of people who've tagged in their friends, and they're like, "You've got to watch this before Sunday." But I had one person on YouTube or Facebook or something who was like, "This is blasphemous. This is terrible. This is really offensive. I'm a Christian," and I wrote back, "Yes, so am I." I was like, "I debuted this at my church, and I kind of feel like I've been given this ability for a reason." So I was quite happy with it. I guess that said, I'm never so righteous that I assume that every decision I make is correct. I mean, with that one, I was pretty confident. But if there was any, actually, there's one that I made for another comic who wrote a song. A comedy song called Kill Yourself, which is actually really, it is very funny, but it's very dark. I made a flip chart for that and I was happy with it. And I didn't actually have any complaints about it, but I did a campaign for the Samaritans and they called me and they said, "We've just realized one of your videos is to a song called Kill Yourself." And I went, "Oh my goodness, you're right. That's really bad." I was like, in the context of when I performed it, it was part of a bigger thing and it made sense. But I realized out of context, that's actually not adding anything useful to society. So I took it offline. So that's not there anymore. So I'm open to understanding that every decision I make might not always be the best one, or in hindsight might not have been the best one. So I try and keep an open mind. But in terms of religious stuff, no, not so much. I had a section in a show once about the Book of Mark. And the idea, and talk about how in it, it specifically says that Jesus heals someone by spitting in their mouth. And I do a whole thing about how I have a theory that Mark didn't like Jesus very much. And he was like, "Yeah, just spit in his mouth." And he's writing. It's really silly, but also at the same time, it was within the context of me saying, I do believe this stuff, but let's just take a moment to understand that sometimes things come across a bit strange when it's 2,000 years on and we're reading it in a book that's been rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. And the amount of Christians I had who said they really enjoyed that bit. And in fact, at least one other Christian comic called Richard Wright, who then said it was the first time he realized that he could talk about his faith as part of his set and not feel like it was in an apologetic way or in a punching down kind of way. It's just in a "this is how I see it" kind of way, but respectful.
And Beck, you said in the past that you've actually faced more discrimination on the comedy circuit for being a woman than for being a Christian. Can you just explain what you meant by that?
So I should preface this all with the fact that the comedy circuit is becoming much better for women, and it's better now than it was 20 years ago. It was better then than it was 20 years before that. And in 20 years' time from now, it'll be even better. So I'm aware that we're all moving towards the right direction. But there are still, I got a message the other day from someone who said, and I get this a fair bit, but I thought I'd move past it, where someone said, thank you for proving to me that women can be funny. And I just thought, when was that ever the question? And it's so annoying when people think that that's a compliment, when they say, oh, I don't normally like female comedians, but I like you. And I'm like, well, all you've said to me just then is, I don't watch enough comedy. Because being female isn't a genre of comedy. What I do is so different from what Aisling Bea does, from what Sarah Pascoe does, from what Deborah Francis White does, from what Catherine Ryan does, from what Lolly Adefope does. Like, we're all completely different performers. And, just because we're female doesn't mean that we're the same type of comedy. So it's really ignorant when people say, oh, I don't normally like female comedians, because I think, well, then you're saying you don't like comedy, because the range is entirely different. And no one ever says it about men, and that's very frustrating. I find that I get reminded that I'm a woman way more than people going, oh, hey, you're a Christian. Like, that's never, or no one says, I didn't think Christians could be funny, but I like you. I don't get that as much. And I guess that's because being female is a lot more obvious than being Christian. You kind of have to have an element of talking about it a lot for them to get that. But it's a really frustrating thing. And it happens in television as well. I've had two instances where it was assumed that they were looking for three hosts for TV shows. And I nearly didn't get the job, because it was decided that if it went to two hosts, it would definitely be two men and not a woman and a man, or not two women. And that was before the commissioners had, in both cases, had seen the audition tapes. So what had happened is the person making the show had gone, okay, so we'll have two or three hosts, either two men or two men and a woman. And that they decided that before they'd seen any of the talent. So I get very frustrated when people say, oh, it should be booked based on talent, not gender. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not now. It's people assume that those are the places for the men, and they get dibs on that. So it's very frustrating. I've found that when people find out that I'm Christian, more often than not, they're really supportive, or sometimes they have some questions. But I mean, the majority of my closest friends on the circuit are atheists, and we never have heated debates. It's always really respectful discussions, and every now and then we might disagree on something, but it's never at a point that it goes beyond our genuine love for each other, and I think that that's or respect for each other, and I think that's probably the best thing I can do as a Christian, is to respect people in a way that I want to be respected. And sometimes that ends up having a much more positive effect than I realize. I have had a few friends, some of which happen to be comics, who have said, oh, I only had bad interactions with Christians growing up. They grew up in an atheist family or something, or an agnostic one, and the only Christians they knew were very evangelical, or they only knew what was happening in the news or things like that. And it wasn't until they got to know me and then found out that I'm Christian that they went, okay. And I say, yeah, like, most of us are like this. We're actually normal. So that's been nice. It's been good. They've been a little bit more open-minded to that.
And going back to talking about women in the industry, do you have any advice for women who are wanting to make their mark in comedy?
Just do it. Just get out there and do it. I think and that's why I always need to preface stuff with saying, like, the industry is getting a lot better, because I worry that sometimes so much focus is put on the discrimination towards being a woman in comedy, or indeed any other person who's seen as a minority in comedy at the moment, that if we focus on that too much, it puts other people off the idea of doing it, because why bother starting when the chances are so low? But my argument is, it is getting better, which means your chances are only getting bigger. So, and the best way to combat that is just to have more women doing it. So I thoroughly encourage women to do it. The only way to make your mark is just be yourself and find your own voice. And that might have something to do with your gender or it might not. In my case, it was that I like drawing and being silly and puns and stories and things like that. So that was very much my thing. And I think that would be the same regardless of what gender I was. But just go out there, do it.
And you're going to be going out there and doing it, aren't you, in a couple of months for the Edinburgh Fringe.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be performing I'll Be Beck.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about what we can look forward to in that show?
Yeah. So the show, the very loose premise is that I've gone into the future to find out what's happening. And I've come back to talk about what's happening in the future and take any questions. And I don't want to give away too much because I've been purposefully vague, because I like an element of surprise in my shows. It's the same reason I like magic shows. I like it when you're not quite sure what's going to happen. So I've been really, really vague in my descriptions of the shows and explaining what happens. But to go into a little bit more detail, especially for your listeners and no one else, it changes pace. So it'll go from my type of stand-up that I've been known for, which is quite loose and playful and cheery. And I try not to lose the fun and cheeriness in it, but it does become more of a reflection of the future. And it's the most personal show I've done in terms of the things that scare me and the things that bother me, because I try and distract myself from them a lot. And I don't want to... I don't want to do a show where people walk out feeling depressed or upset. I think a lot of people go to comedy because they need a break from life. But I did need to do a show that talked about the things that are really weighing on my heart, and this is going to be one of those shows. But there is enough things in there that I think people will be constantly surprised and hopefully still leave the show feeling somewhat positive.
And where do you draw inspiration from for new material, such as this new show?
Well, this new show I've been planning for 5 years. So I had the idea in Edinburgh. Most of my shows I end up writing while I'm performing a show in Edinburgh. So I get about halfway through Edinburgh Fringe, and then I have an idea for, I'd really love to do this on stage. And then that becomes the premise of the next show. So that tends to go on and on and on. And I had this idea, years and years ago. And I thought, that'd be amazing. What a great show that'd be to put on. But it heavily depended on my abilities. I didn't feel that I was a strong enough comic to pull it off. There's a lot more writing in this show than there have been in previous ones. The previous ones are, as I said, a lot more chaotic and loose. So I can be a bit more conversational with the way that I deliver things. Whereas this one, I have to be quite clear about what I'm saying because it is so important that I say it right. So I wanted to become a better writer. And I also knew that a lot of the stuff I wanted to put in there would involve quite a high budget, so I had to start saving money. So thankfully, I don't have any dependents in terms of, I don't have any kids, I don't have a mortgage, I don't have anything that I have to put my money on. So essentially, all of my savings have gone into the show, and I'm not going to make them back because the Fringe is not a good thing to try and make money on. Even if I sell out the whole run, I'll be losing money. And I'm only not losing loads of money because everyone who has helped me put the show together has done so on a heavily discounted rate, in some cases free. So I knew I would have to get to a point where I could put it on, but I don't think I can do it again after this, just for financial reasons. So with that one, it was very much, I had 5 years to put it together and to write it. And this one I wrote far more like a script. The opening part of the show I was able to play around with at clubs and be a bit looser, but the rest of the show was very, very much meticulously planned. There were moments where I would wake up at 4 a.m. because a phrasing had popped into my head and woken me up, and I'd had to And I knew I would lose it otherwise, so I'd end up getting up and then sitting at my laptop and writing it out. And I remember my husband coming to the lounge one night and saying, like, what are you doing? And I said, I couldn't sleep. I had to get this out. So this show had a lot of that. But previous shows have been different. A lot of the things I tend to write are notes that I either write down on my phone or on a piece of paper, and then I'll grab them all and expand them a little bit, and then I'll go to a comedy club and I'll just stand there and go, okay, and then just go through them and see what seems to have legs, what might work, and then go away and try and work out how to make it stronger and how to make it better, and then eventually you'll end up with an hour of them and then you've got a new show on your hands.
Beck, when you're talking about those moments in the middle of the night when you wake up, do you feel like in those moments those are sort of God-inspired moments? Do you feel like your gift and your comedy is something that sort of you connect with God, the creator, to produce?
More so now, yeah. I do. There was a time where I used to do a podcast years and years and years ago with another now writer called Bridie Lee Kennedy. She's another Aussie. And we did a podcast called Gods of Comedy, and it was where we interviewed different comedians about what they believe in and their faith. And when we were putting out those episodes, it was before I had found my current church. And so it was known that I had a faith, but I didn't have a church. And one of my problems had been for years, I felt like I'd chosen comedy over chaplaincy. And I felt like I was cheating on God because my parents have been incredibly supportive of my whole family has been so supportive of me going into comedy, and the only person being that I felt like I was letting down was God. I felt like God wanted me to go into chaplaincy and I'd taken this more, I wouldn't say glamorous, but more interesting to me path. And I had a moment when I was at a gig. It was a very small new material gig, and the only other people in the audience were the other comedians who were on, and most of us knew each other, and I realized it's a nice way of socializing and seeing my friends again, but also supporting each other, and sometimes we'd give each other feedback and notes after the gig, and these people you'd end up sort of meeting up with outside of comedy, or if someone, not just that gig, but in terms of the comedy community, most recently someone has had to have a kidney out, and it was very last minute, and so another comic did a GoFundMe page, and they raised the money that comic will miss out on for the next 3 months in a day, because basically every comedian went, and comedians who don't even know this guy, but they just went, well, that could be any of us, and everyone just gave money. And I slowly started to realize while I was at this little gig and it was a little bit hit and miss, and I thought, oh, this is sort of my church, this is my community. But instead of feeling really bad about it, it felt like an epiphany. It felt like, oh, I've been put here. Like this is I'm meant to be here. And it was the feeling of relief that I had when I went, oh, this whole time I've been fighting it, and now I can just go, oh, this was a gift. This is something that I'm supposed to be doing, and I was given this passion for a reason, and I'm not defying anyone by following it. Why else would I have this passion for it? And that made a huge difference. That completely switched the way. And I'd argue, I've since having that realization, I've become a far better comedian, because there's not this weird hindrance on me anymore that makes me feel like I can't fully commit to it. Whereas since then, I find that I'm a lot more into it, and also a lot more open to moments like that where you just are struck by that sort of, yeah, basically by God sort of going, poof. All right, and then you go, oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
Do you ever get stage fright?
I get nervous. I get nervous almost always. In fact, the gigs where I don't feel nervous are usually the ones that end up going terribly, because I'm overly confident and then I let myself down. So I still get nervous. But stage fright, one or two times I'll blank, but I've started to realize that that's fine. And more often than not, I talk so quickly that if I blank, people just think that I'm giving them a chance to catch up. And then I'll go, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what I was going to talk about. But it takes a lot of getting used to doing that on stage for you to realize, oh, it's not as scary as I thought it was. People think heckles and stage fights are the worst, and they're not. The worst is silence, because when people don't laugh, then there's nothing you can do. Whereas with a heckler, there's an array of responses you can do, or no response, but you have a choice. Whereas with silence, there's nothing you can do. You're only left with your own feeling of, oh, I haven't done something right, but you don't know what. So yeah, I would say I probably fear silence more than I fear stage fright or heckles.
And Beck, you perform for children quite a bit, don't you? Mm. What one joke do children laugh at the most?
Oh, they love farts. They love farts, which is great because I think farts are funny too. So we're very much on the same mindset there. Yeah, I think one of my favorite things to talk to kids about, I tell the kids I don't like Spider-Man, which is controversial. I mean, to say that in front of, you know, 400 7-year-olds is you'll get quite the response. But I say I don't like Spider-Man because Spider-Man shoots webs from his wrists. And that's not where spiders make webs from. And I say, give me shout out if you know where a spider makes web from. And they'll go, yeah, it's bum. It's bum. I say, yeah, it's bum. I want to see that movie. I want to go to the movies and see Peter Parker say, I'll save you. Like that's, and they like that, but I like that too, because I would watch that film. So, yeah, it's unfortunately very stereotypical, but you can never go wrong with bums and farts.
And what about the comedians that you most admire? Who do you sort of watch and think, yeah, that what they do is excellent?
Oh, I think my favourite ones are ones who do stuff that is so much more than what I do. So, I mean, when I started out, obviously now Josie Long is incredible, and she's done Greenbelt Festival quite a few years, I think. And she is incredibly wholesome in a sense that that just feels right. Josie Long, I thoroughly recommend if people are feeling a bit down about the world. And sometimes her stuff is about how the world is a bit rubbish, but you're like, oh, finally, someone else who agrees with me. I feel heard. And her stuff is really it's a correct anger rather than a anger for the sake of being angry. So Joe Song's fantastic, but I would say most recently the ones that have really I just love Spencer Jones, who's a prop comic, sort of character prop comic, and he's got a BBC series coming out soon. He has a character called the Herbert, and he's just uses everyday household items in really strange ways, and that really speaks to me. It's almost clowning, but I hate saying the word clown because everyone expects the big red nose, but Spencer Jones just fills me with so much joy. His show Proper Job, Herbert Gets a Proper Job, I think it was, maybe about 3 or 4 years ago at Fringe, I saw it so many times, that Fringe, and I saw it specifically if I'd had a bad day, I'd go and watch it because it just made me so happy. So Spencer Jones, big ups there. Trigvi Wakenshaw is another physical comic, but it's mainly sort of mime, but with he sort of will make a few sounds or might say one word or something, but he'll do a whole hour where it's just him imagining stuff and pretending that he's a baby bird who's getting fed, and it's really dumb and really surreal and very enjoyable. And again, it's stuff that Spencer Jones, I just couldn't. People look at the flip charts and they're like, wow, that takes ages, so much effort. I would never go to that much effort. But I look at Spencer Jones and I'm like, oh, I would never go to that much effort. I mean, the effort he puts into his stuff is incredible. And Trigvi is physically funny in a way that I will never be, because I just don't have that physique. Or the patience to go through with learning it all, but he's incredible. So I think watching anyone who does something that I just don't do, Fox Dog Studios is another one that I would thoroughly recommend that people check out. It's not really stand-up comedy, which is probably why I love it, but they are they make robots, basically, that you can interact with via your phone, and their comedy is really understated. I guess the best way I could describe it is, because they don't do so much musical comedy, but if you took the understated style of Flight of the Conchords and then made them nerds who make robots, that's Fox Dog Studios. I really like their stuff.
And Beck, what are you most proud of so far in your career?
Ooh, I know exactly what one of my proudest moments is. I did a kids gig in Guildford, and before I was introduced, the MC, who's also one of my good friends, Matt Heighton, said, your headliner act is a brilliant act, and she's a good friend of mine. And a kid in the front, I couldn't see the front because I was offside stage, but a kid in the front went, "She?" And he went, "Yeah, she, women can do comedy too," which the parents all had a chuckle at. And then he introduced me and I came on, and I had a really good set. I was really proud of myself. And I finished up. And as I was packing up afterwards, a mum came up to me and she said, "I just wanted to let you know that my daughter was the one who yelled out 'she,' and she wasn't saying it because she couldn't believe it. She was saying it because she was very excited because today's her birthday. She's having a birthday party here, and she specifically said she wanted to go and see some comedy for her birthday. So she was very excited that there was a woman on the bill, because I don't think she'd ever seen a woman on a comedy bill, but well, live." And so she said that wasn't an incredulous she, that was a excited she. And she said, "So basically they were wondering if they could come and meet you." And I said, "Yeah, of course." And I was just surrounded by these 7-year-olds who were going, "Why did you start doing comedy? Did you do drama? What's your favorite comedy show? What that?" And like just all these questions. But like, and then "I do drama too," and just all this stuff. And I just went, "Oh gosh," because that's the thing, isn't it? It's about representation. And it's about it. You can't, it's harder to be something you can't see. So to just have like a whole group of girls see that, and to a further extent, you know, having anyone really see a woman on stage from such an early age, that places it in the norm, as the norm. So those kids are going to grow up going, "Oh, that's normal. That there is nothing different about this. Comedy is a place for anyone, regardless of who or whatever you are." So I think, yeah, that's my pride. I think that's the stuff that gives me the biggest pride.
And looking forward to the future now, what are your plans for the coming months?
So obviously Edinburgh is for the month of August, and then I am going to try and go on holiday in September. Mm-hmm. Because my husband's directing the show that I'm taking to Edinburgh, and he's also producing it now, because I actually got to be in a play in June, and it's the first play I've ever been in, and I was very stressed, and everyone was great in the play and the director, so I was only stressed because it was the first play I'd auditioned for and got and was in, so I was very nervous. But during that time was also peak Edinburgh prep time, so my husband had jumped in and basically taken over all of the logistics and admin and everything, and as well as his full-time job and trying to do his own thing. So that was incredible. So I'm hoping, his birthday's in September, so I'm hoping we can go on holiday for his birthday as a nice little reward to ourselves. October, I might be doing some gigs in the Middle East, which I'm intrigued by, I think, because I've always wanted to go to the Middle East, but I don't think it's going to be the areas that I want to see in terms of a pilgrimage. I think it's going to be more performing to people in the oil industry, which has me in mixed emotions. And then onwards, I don't know. I'm planning on potentially going back to Australia in January to do some gigs and see my family, but I'm keeping it quite open. There's a lot of stuff and there's a lot of things that are in the oven, and I don't know if they'll be done or if they'll burn. So there might be more announcements as time goes on, but for now there's some things cooking, some things baking. Some of them might be good. Most of them will probably get fed to the birds.
Well, it's been a real pleasure chatting to you, Beck. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, sadly, that's all we've got time for today. But see you next week. Same time, same place.
Everyone has a fave Wendy's frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new frosty swirls and frosty fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo brownie fusion, Pop-Tarts strawberry fusion, strawberry swirl, brownie batter swirl, caramel swirl, and caramel crunch fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co., LLC. Used with permission.